Okay, we do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to start hearing testimony. And the first bill is by Representative Thiessen, and it's House File 1405.
Thank you.
For those in the audience that are going to testify, we're going to have to run a relatively tight timeline because the session ran a little longer than we thought. We thought we'd, we're already 45 minutes late. So, Representative Thiessen.
With that, Mr. Chair, I am going to, well, first of all, can I move the A4 amendment to get the...
We can't do that yet.
Oh, because they're not a quorum.
You want to
okay.
describe your amendment?
Well, I'm going to just let, I'm going to just turn it over in the interest of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I represent the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, but I'm speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative on this proposal. To the amendment, just a brief description. This is language that was worked out to address some concerns raised by the department. I'll try to summarize as briefly as possible what the amendment does. The first couple of lines of the amendment deals with the incidental nursing services provision of the bill and clarifies the language relating to injections of insulin and also deletes out a reference to nursing assessments to try to clarify the types of incidental nursing services that we will be working on there. The second part of the amendment, starting at lines 1.9 through 2.2, revamps the proposal that we have on dealing with enhanced nursing services for dealing with acute cases. After discussing this with the department, we felt that perhaps a more practical first step is to make this a pilot demonstration project. And so we are proposing to try this out on a two-year demonstration project that would deal with up to 500 clients. And would allow the department then to study how that is working after 2 years. The last part of the amendment then, starting with lines 2.4 through 2.8, deals with the study and clarifies that the study will also look at the length of time it takes case managers to respond to requests to assess changes in elderly waiver participants. So it clarifies that part of the process. So in part, in total, this amendment deals with some of the concerns that have been raised on this bill and we think makes it more clear as to what our intent is.
Still a little short. Do you have another person to testify?
I don't know if you want to testify.
Okay, sure. Well, she's Mr. Chair.
On the bill.
This is to the bill. Would you like testimony on the bill
sure,
as well?
No. And we actually don't even have to amend this if you want to just keep these together if we don't get to a quorum, you know. Presumably it'll either be incorporated or not. So, okay. So we can go to the bill, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. I just note on that amendment, I don't have the full fiscal note here, but I think a lot of the cost is in Section 3, was in Section 3, and this should actually lower the cost of the fiscal note as well. So, for the committee's interest.
And so then, Mr. Chair, just to start off the testimony on the bill, again, we want to thank Representative Thiessen and others for supporting this House File 1405. We believe that dealing with these important policy changes to the elderly waiver program is part of the entire discussion on long-term care, improving access and affordability to long-term care. As I stated in the policy committee, our research indicates that we will need to serve an additional 2,500 to 4,400 seniors through home and community-based services each year and build nearly 17,000 additional units of assisted living by 2030. Our research also indicates that if we do not have sufficient access to home and community-based services, the need for skilled nursing facilities will go up. Again, briefly, this bill relates to Minnesota's elderly waiver program. which funds home and community-based services for people age 65 and older who are eligible for medical assistance and require the level of care provided in a nursing home but who choose to reside in the community. The Minnesota Department of Human Services operates the EW program under a federal waiver to Minnesota's state Medicaid plan, and the counties administer this program. Among other things, the EW program pays for bundled packages of services called customized living and 24-hour customized living. And these bundled packages are made available in senior buildings and include various supportive health-related services by EW recipients. Mr. Chair, we have one of our members here who would like to speak to some provisions of the bill as well.
Okay. Please identify yourself for
the statement. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Van Winkle, and I'm director of Shalom Home Healthcare, which is in St. Louis Park. I want to talk a little bit about the bill authorizing EW to pay for specified incidental nursing services within the customized living packages. Although the EW program will pay for these nursing services on a fee-for-service basis, currently the EW customized living packages permits reimbursement only for medication setups and prohibits possibility of reimbursement for other services that can be offered by a licensed nurse. Incidental nursing services identified in this provision are services that either by law or by standards of nursing practice cannot be delegated to unlicensed home care staff and must be provided by a licensed nurse. In addition, these provisions specify the incidental nursing services to be covered by EW packages are services that are not covered by Medicare home care. We also want to note that this provision will not affect the client service cap, that the limits of amount of reimbursement possible each month for the client services under the existing program guidelines. Authorization for payment for these incidental nursing services will be allowed only if the client has a documented need for the services and the total cost of the services, including the incidental nursing services, is less than the monthly service cap. I have a couple of scenarios that I think that this would fit under, and I'd like to speak to those. First of all, the one I want to cover first is injections. Unlicensed staff are prohibited from administering injections except for under very certain circumstances. Insulin can sometimes be injected, but other injections cannot be done if it's assessed by the RN that it's not safe for an unlicensed person to provide those services. So in the case of a diabetic client who is unable to administer his or her own insulin, providers like my program must choose between absorbing the cost of giving the injections or declining to provide the service. If the provider can't absorb the cost and administer the injections for free, the client may have to choose to go to a nursing home where there's licensed personnel available 24 hours. Monitoring blood tests for those clients with chronic conditions such as congestive heart failure, COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, diabetes, or chronic urinary tract infections, regular RN monitoring of blood tests is essential to determine if treatments or medications need to be changed. And this monitoring are critical to avoid emergency situations where you have to then place the person in the hospital. So allowing the nurse to be able to have an ongoing monitoring of these chronic conditions, then we can avoid hospitalizations. As more frail seniors receive care outside nursing homes, it is likely that they will require more services directly from licensed nurses, and we believe that customized living service packages should pay for these services when Medicare does not apply.
Mr. Chair, briefly to Section 2 of the bill. This is one of the sections that will be amended if and when the amendment is adopted, that creates a demonstration project, but would still allow the department to test a project that would allow an EW client to access higher monthly service cap for a period of 30 days or less if the case manager agrees that it would allow the client to avoid hospitalization or nursing home placement. And this really deals with patients that are either becoming unstable or has dealt with an acute episode. We'd be happy to provide examples, but in the interest of time, I think we've already discussed that provision as well.
I think that's section 3 of the amended.
Right.
No, that's fine.
And we now have 11 of us checked in, so Representative Thiessen moves that House File 1405 be recommended to pass. Obviously, I'm going to change that and get to the end. I will should have called the meeting order first. So I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Thiessen recommends or moves that House File 1405 be recommended to pass. Representative Peterson, would you like to move the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we accept the minutes from.
Okay, it's been moved and.
Tuesday, March.
Yeah, for the 13th of March. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We've adopted the minutes, and Representative Thiessen, you can continue.
Can I move the A4 amendment?
Representative Thiessen moves the A4 amendment to House File 1405. And that's already been discussed. Any discussion of that amendment? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment is adopted, and continue with House File 1405.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think the only, all I would conclude with is that I think that the suggested changes here really are very kind of practical ways to address some issues that we've kind of experienced in this area. They're very narrowly focused, getting at kind of real practical problems, and I think some good practical solutions have been suggested here, so I'd encourage members' consideration.
Any discussion? Seeing none, House File 1405 will be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Right there in my corner. Next, we have House File 320 with Representative Enzel. And I'll move that House File 320 be recommended to pass. Representative Enzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 320 is about 35 publicly owned and operated nursing facilities throughout the state. It's about public workers who work in those facilities throughout the state, and it's about their pensions. It's about PERA. As you know, public employees are entitled to be participants in PERA for their pensions. Unfortunately, in the 2005 session of the legislature, when nursing home rates were being approved by the body, the increased costs associated with PERA obligations from the employer were not dealt with in the alternative payment system contracts. And so, therefore, this legislation seeks to modify what we think was an oversight. And that's basically the bill. And Terry Thurlow, of course, is here to help answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be very brief. I think Representative Enzel has summarized the bill. This would deal with employer obligations for the PERA, those that have those obligations. The state does mandate increases of the employer obligations, but as of right now, the rates provided to facilities do not reflect those increasing costs. And so this provision will allow those obligations to also be considered as part of the rate. This was language that was provided to the department after a rate appeal by the Little Fork facility, and so we would encourage your support. Thank you.
Any discussion? Representative Thiessen.
I think it's something we really need to do. It's just kind of one of those unfair oversight kind of issues. So I thank you for bringing this forward. And
okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, House File 320 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
We've passed out part of the fiscal note for 1405, which was not here when the bill was presented. Next is House File 721, Representative Fritz. And Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I am pleased and honored to be here today to present House File 721 along with Representative Hosh. Well, and all of the folks who have been involved in this legislation for many years. I have two amendments that I'd like to take up first, if I could.
Representative Fritz, why don't you move your bill first?
I'm sorry. I'd like to move House File 721.
Representative Fritz has moved the House File 1721, and we're now discussing amendments.
I have the A7 amendment, and this is the rebasing. And I also want to let the members and Mr. Chairman yourself know that we have had a working committee. We have met twice in the first committee meeting that we all met at. I think that, you know, it was just a consensus right away that this, if not now, when we need to fix this problem of the rebasing. And so we have come up with an amendment, and I believe I have Patty Cullum here, and she can speak to the amendment if you all have that in front of you. And please welcome to the committee, Cullum.
Representative Fritz moves the A7 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patty Cullen, Vice President of Care Providers in Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I think we've mentioned to this committee before that the purpose of rebasing is to bridge the gap between facility rates and costs, and that's what this proposal does. Our initial language that we drafted with our national consultant did rebasing one-time deal starting on October 1st. The fiscal implications of doing it all at once were a little bit surprising to us. So we came back with this language to have a three-year phase-in. In doing so, we actually reduced the total cost of it, because if you're assuming there's going to be some rate increases that helps bridge that gap between rates and costs, the total at the end of 3 years is actually a little bit less than doing it all at once anyway. In addition, the three-year phase-in, our calculations that we've done show that there's about 6 facilities in the state that would not be helped by rebasing to some degree or another. Those 6 facilities will be held harmless for the 3-year period of the phase-in of the rebasing. At that point in time, there would be an issue with these 6 facilities. From our preliminary analysis, we have to figure out if there's any changes in legislation over the 3 years, that number would change, of course. One of the facilities, for example, is the Courage Residence, which is a very specialized facility, and they have their own special legislation there. There would be those 6 facilities that would have to be taken care of or considered at some point after the rebasing because of their specialty services. But I think only 6 of 392 wouldn't see some level of benefit. The other thing this rebasing language does, without going line by line through the amendment, is it incorporates the case mix weight issue. In Senate File 721, there is a section that does change the case mix weights to the new staff measures that we came up with several years ago. When you use those weights with the new rebasing, then you don't have to do that separate expenditure. So we're saving you money right off the bat by doing rebasing, incorporating the new case mix weights. We wanted to make sure folks knew that. In addition, there are a couple divisions within the rebasing language I just want to draw your attention to. The first is we acknowledge that there were some differences in the staffing arrangements that the hospital-attached facilities have to abide by, frankly, because they have nurses and direct care staff that work across the continuum of their services. So we did carve out the CNCs and did a separate calculation in the rebasing formula for that group for the direct care component. They're grouped in one group, then all of the nursing facilities are grouped in the other. In addition, in working with our national consultant, we actually did come back with some percentages that places limits on how much you can get receive in your costs based on the outcome. The outcome is making sure that a healthy percentage of your Medicaid costs are being covered. We've estimated that right now we're at about 86% coverage rate, which is pretty much unheard of in the nation. The goal was to get to close to what the national expectation is, about 95%, and this proposal actually puts us at about 96.5%, somewhere around there. And the reason for that extra little percentage of cost coverage for Medicaid dollars is because we have rate equalization, and other states don't have that. So that's kind of the global picture of what this does. I can answer any questions if you have any of the specific lines on here, but I think that kind of covers it.
So Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of questions. I was trying to read the reimbursement rates. You said that the facilities would all be held harmless, and I can't tell. So what does that mean? Does that mean they would stay at the same rates that they are, or they would get an annual increase? Because I have a feeling that most of those are in the metro area, or in my area at least. I'm not sure. They were at one point in time. And having spent several days in the summer at one of my facilities that didn't have that, where the air conditioning went out and I didn't have resources to do what needed to be. I mean, they certainly kept the patients, I think, well cared for, but did not have resources to put in the new conditioning units, the kinds of things that needed to be done. So I'm real concerned if hold harmless means that they don't get adequate increases, and it seems, and am I looking at these formulas wrong, or can you help me with this?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson.
Go on.
First of all, I neglected to mention that we rebase the operating rates only. And so your example of air conditioning is a property rate issue, just to make sure folks know that. The six facilities are the ones that are held harmless. Everyone else will see an increase. So in the three-year phase-in, everyone will see a phased-in increase to their rates except for those six facilities, which will be held harmless, and that means their rates won't be reduced because their costs, I mean, their rates are higher than other facilities. And I don't have the list with me, unfortunately, so I can't tell you the other six, but I know which facility you're talking about, and they're not one of them.
Okay. I have three more in my district, so big ones.
These really are very unique facilities. Either they were all private pay facilities and converted to MA and received an interim rate that made their rates unusually high, or they have special legislation already that makes their rates unusually high compared to everyone else in there. So it's above the percentage that rebasing would pay.
Representative Peterson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that explains. I would be interested in all six of them that are being affected. Just so at least we could talk to the resident, those folks, and know who they are, and get some feedback from them about what this means for them.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at the end of the 3 years, where will we be left with regard? I mean, part of this is getting at the issues you were working at in the working group about the differential rates. Where will we be after 3 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, after 3 years, the cost coverage ratio, meaning the percentage of MA costs, should be hovered at about the 96% level.
For everybody?
For everybody.
Okay. So.
And we've put in here a future look to regularly rebase rates, and I think it's every other year, depending on which year is the first year we started. The reason the fiscal note's so high and the gap so big is because we haven't rebased since 1990.
Yeah. Representative Easton.
I don't know if Representative... So I can just be clear, Mr. Chair. So all the individual bills that we've been seeing about bringing people up, that issue will be solved, in a sense, with this? Am I correct about that?
Mr.
After
Chair...
After 3 years, or largely?
Representative Thiessen, yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, to the extent everyone's rates will be increased except for those six facilities, to the point where it should have cost coverage. There still will be rate differentials.
And Mr. Chair, I see that there's three categories by county.
We worked very hard over a period of months to come up with the breakdown of the groups that we put in this bill. We put them in this bill because there is a recognition that costs vary in different parts of the state. And that in some cases, if we didn't have this, the fiscal note not only would be huge, much bigger than it is right now, but you may have a situation where facilities would actually get more money than they can spend because of the cost structures in their community. So we put together this plan, and in running the modeling and the data at the end, each of the three groups came out with numbers that give them an equivalent cost coverage ratio. So then we knew we were about as close as we could possibly be with the numbers, because each of the groups showed the same statistics at the end when we ran the model.
Ms. Cullen, if currently you a nursing home is in an area that was getting a lower rate, I would then think that they were paying their employees at a lower rate than other ones. Are we just locking in that lower wage scale if we pass this rebasing?
Mr. Chair, probably not. And I say that because they may be paying a lower rate, but in every community, if they have a hospital nearby, if they're hospital attached, they've been paying what they need to get to try to attract workers. And so in some cases, right across the street, you would see different wage scales. Our concern is that if they have real costs and their rates don't match, those need to be matched up. Moving ahead, we're rebasing again. So, and we're giving increases in between. So once we kind of flatline folks and move forward, if there really is a situation where they've artificially kept down the pay scale, we'll catch up to that.
And Ms. Cullen, what is the fiscal note for this amendment?
I believe the first year is $25 million around, and then in the next biennium, it's over $50 million. State.
I'd like to say thank you, but... Wow.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to comment, it wasn't really a surprise to us. We did the studies that showed the gap is about $19 a day, and so... We expected that, and I would also note that you just recently had the forecast change pages, and hospital rebasing was $91
million. Yes. Mm-hmm. Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As always, I'm looking at the small town, no hospital, nursing home, and I know they got hit at the very beginning in 1985, and so they sort of stayed in that lower piece. And so how are they going to fare in those areas? Because I have a lot of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, with rebasing, those facilities will see a rate adjustment, an increase, and if indeed their costs were artificially held down for whatever reason, and some of these facilities did receive a low rate bump up when we did the base plus slide, and I forget because it's been years, in 2000 maybe, there was an attempt one of these past years to bump up the low rates initially. So that was a little bit of a help. In the future, if you do regular rebasing and continue to provide an adjustment in the years where you're not doing rebasing, their costs should be almost covered. Again, the goal is 96% coverage of costs, and if their costs to keep their workers and attract their workers if they have to pay them more, that will catch up to them in the system.
Representative Trumbull.
Representative, Mr. Chair, that's the catch. Where is the money to raise those salaries? That's the problem.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba. The rebasing amendment here, I think, would help out our small communities in one of the greatest ways. As we can see with the change in groupings for Stearns County, just last year has encouraged more facilities or more areas to move forward with over 20 bills to be included in a new rate grouping. If we rebase, that should prevent that from happening into the future, and hopefully our reimbursements will more fairly reflect the actual cost. Secondly, I think the most important component of this is that we need to rebase on a consistent method. Mm-hmm. If we only rebase like we have in the past years, we're running into this very same situation that we are in now. So I think for the communities that I represent, like Painesville, in which has one rate for their nursing home, and then in Watkins, in which they're 50 yards away from the county line and have a completely different rate, we can prevent that from happening. So I think this is a very integral component to the nursing home bill.
One more piece.
Representative Drummond.
Mr. Chair. And, of course, we butt up to Stearns County, so we have that added problem. Not in the in the nursing home area especially, but we have our nurses driving to St. Cloud making $20 an hour more. And thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Ms. Cullen, to what extent does, it's Representative Fritz's the lead all, support the reform that the department is trying to accomplish in regard to rebasing?
Ms. Cullen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, we haven't had a rebasing proposal from the department. Several years ago, they had a value-based reimbursement component, and this bill does include a portion of that, the quality add-on, and using the quality measures is a different section of this bill. It's still included.
Thank you.
We have not voted on the amendment, so is there any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. You want to continue with your bill?
I do.
Representatives Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, I have the A7 amendment. Pardon me, A8 amendment.
Representative Fritz moves the A8 amendment.
And this amendment is the piece in the bill that talks about the encumbrance of the, specifically the 75% of the money that the nursing home will receive, as I proposed, the 5% and 5%. 75% of that will go to the direct care worker. And we have had that discussion in our working group, and we've had consensus on that, and this amendment is that we're asking to include that in the bill. Would you like to speak to that? I have
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. This is language that was... For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, and speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, the A8 Amendment is language that has been agreed to both by the Imperative and the Seniors and Workers Group, in addition to specifying a rate increase and an encumbered percentage. It also clarifies the language used to determine the encumbered amount. There were concerns... I believe as early as last session with how the encumbrance was dealt with. This clarifies, and I think both the seniors and workers and the providers are happy with this clarifying language.
And Ms. Thurlow, does this relate to the COLA, or does it relate to the rebasing?
Mr. Chair, this relates to the COLA, and it's for nursing facilities only.
Okay, any questions? Any further discussion on the A8 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I was out of the room for briefly. This is an agreement that they've reached?
Yes.
Does the agreement turn on the actual percentage? Does the agreement turn on it being 5%?
The bill is still 5 and 5, and,
right.
And that's, yes, on the 5%.
Does that, if it's not 5%, does that change the agreement? Is
no.
What I'm saying. Okay.
Okay, any further discussion on the A8 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? A8 amendment is adopted. Back to the bill then.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you for the... good questions on those amendments, and now the bill is a good bill. We're moving forward, and there are some testifiers here, and I do want to, first of all, thank everyone involved. This has been a long process. I've been coming up here on this particular piece of legislation for 7 years, meeting with the Seniors and Workers for Quality, and I know that all of the other folks in the nursing home world have also been working for at least 7 to 10 years on this and longer. I myself have been in the business 40 years, and I testified for 20 some of those years, so it is an honor and privilege to be able to have a good bill like this moving forward. And I'd like to first, we have some folks who are in support of the bill, and I'd like to bring them up. People that have been working on this, and first of all, I'd like to have Iris Freeman from the Seniors and Workers say just a few words, and we'll be brief.
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Iris Freeman, and I have worked on House File 721 on behalf of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition. In recognition of time and recognizing we've done so much substance, it seems overkill to go back to prologue. I just want to remember the testimony that Mike Henderson, the worker from the Chris Jensen home, gave just a few short days ago. That is what this is about, his life as a caregiver on the floor. Right now, over at the Capitol, members of the Seniors and Workers for Quality are gathering the hospitality of AARP in support of this bill and its Senate counterparts. The theme for this gathering is care for the caregiver, and we know you care. You care more than Valentine's. We have visited with every one of you, and we know how you feel about these things. We have a few more lawmakers to visit in the process, I believe. But we commend the provisions of House File 721 as elements to be high priorities for consideration in the omnibus bill. These are the measures that will care for the caregivers whom we entrust with our loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Freeman, and I believe we do have some other people who would like to come up and testify in support as well, and I also wanted to give my gratitude to my fellow brothers and sisters who are doing the work at the bedside from SEIU, UFCW, and AFSCME. I have all of those folks back in my nursing homes in my district, so they've spent many hours, Jim Fawson and folks like that in the audience here today, so this is indeed a happy moment. Thank you.
Could you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the division. I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of, excuse me, I've got a sore in my mouth, an association of about 160 providers of who support and serve people with disabilities across Minnesota, an ICFMR waiver, various waivers, the DD waiver, CADI waiver, TAC waiver, and TBI waiver. And Representative Fritz, you referred to this as a good bill. I would refer to it as a wonderful bill. And thank you very much for all of your hard work and putting this together. With me is Rita McNilish Hastings, who I can speak from a little bit from a fiscal point of view, but she has been in the field as a direct support professional, the person who would benefit directly from this bill for some 20 years, I believe, and doing 34 years. Well, I'm starting
very young.
Yeah, well, we're about the same age, I think. But I wanted to give you just a very, very quick perspective. The governor's bill provided 2%, and we're deeply appreciative of where we are now, and I know you have some very difficult decisions to make. But just to give you a sense of how far that goes, a typical worker, and it varies across the state, makes $10.77. And a 2% increase would give that person about 22 cents, which would be about $457 a year. Now, I heard on the radio this morning that the price of gas has gone up in the last 2 weeks by 30 cents. So just to get a little more conservative than that, and say it went up over the year 10 cents. And a person drove 100 miles a week. That would come to $520, which is more than the 2% would provide. And then you compound that with where we've been, went through some tough times, we all have, in the last few years. And while we did get some increases, we're very appreciative of what the House did and leading that charge, but they came to over 4 years 3.53%, while at the same time, overall inflation increased 12.77%. So Rita's purchasing power has significantly declined while she's been continuing to do remarkable work. I also want to just point out that folks who maybe haven't been around that much, that when we get 2% or 5% as providers, and almost all of that money is passed on to the direct support professionals, that money also is divided. It has to go for health care and also other operating costs, the heating bill or the price of gas that I just talked about. And when you, so it's not like a state employee contract where you have all the money going to wages and then a separate deal for health insurance. This does everything. So I did want to, Mr. Chair, make one technical observation in the bill, and I trust you intend to put it in, but in the list of community providers, one program was left out that's in your bill, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Briley's mental health bill as well, and that is the ARMS program, people with mental health issues, and would appreciate your taking a look at that, and including that, and if there is something in the omnibus bill, that also be on the list. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rita to just talk briefly about what you got.
Mr. Nelson, before you go, could you make sure you get me a little note on that?
Mr. Chair, I'll actually do that.
A very short one would be fine.
I wish to thank the committee for inviting me to speak on the COLA. My name is Rita McInnes Hastings, and I work for Dakota Communities Incorporated. I'm also the chair of the Direct Support Professional Association of Minnesota. Since being asked to testify at this committee and knowing that I have a short period of time to talk to you, I have gone through a lot of scenarios to try and come up with the right words to help you make the decision to support the COLA. Let me tell you who I am. I started in this field in 1966, working in the state regional centers. Like many of the young people of today, I worked for the state until going off to college, where with my education, I would get a good paying job and be able to afford the things that we all want, a home, a car, the occasional vacation. Somewhere along the line, after working in a variety of commercial and nonprofits, I found myself answering an ad by Dakota Communities. I thought I can do this for a while until I find something I like better, and that will help me afford the above-mentioned things. What I did not count on was that I would find that my initial decision of what I wanted to do with my life at 16 was the right one. So I have now worked for DCI for over 25 years. Between my degree in developmental psychology and 34 years' experience in training, I'm very good at what I do. I see my job as building bridges between the people I serve and the community in which they want to become fully integrated members. That means interpreting for individuals who sometimes have no ability to state what they need or want. In order to do this job, I have to have a relationship with the people that I serve and know them well enough to be able to understand them. Another aspect of my job is training and supervising direct support professionals or advocates, and in that role, I have trained dozens of individuals over 25 years. There is nothing more exciting in that role than to train someone who sees the people we serve as individuals who are so much more than their disabilities and can see the potential of each individual. There is nothing more frustrating than to watch those people walk away because they cannot afford to stay in this field due to the high cost of medical insurance and the low wages. If your child came to you after 4 years of college, which conservatively costs $30,000, to tell you that they were very excited about finding the perfect job and the starting wage was less than $10 an hour, you might not be as excited as they are. If they further informed you that in spite of years of education that they might not get a raise since the raises are not based on their abilities, you might talk to them about finding a less exciting but more financially secure job. And if in addition they let you know that as a single parent, which I am, that they plan to have a home, a car, the occasional vacation, and raise their child or children on less than $10 an hour, you might start wondering how many more years you were going to support this child and your grandchildren. Yet this is the reality of DSPs, and I really can't tell you how we manage to do this. I do know that as my generation is looking forward to retirement, that finding those bright, dedicated individuals becomes harder and harder. I can train them, but I can't make them stay. I realize that many people come before this committee asking for money, and that's what I'm here to do, too. Without the COLA, we will continue to have a revolving door of bright, educated individuals pausing the life of the people we serve only to move on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Any questions or discussion of the bill? Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just can't let the opportunity go by, as I so often find myself in this position, but I just want to thank you for the work that you do and for your testimony. It was really quite moving, and I appreciate it very much.
Other questions, comments? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pitts, for all the work you've done, not just on this bill, but throughout the years working on behalf of direct care workers in our nursing homes. I know in my district, the folks who are doing that work are not doing it for the money, and it's a shame to lose some of those folks to Applebee's and Hardee's because of financial reasons. So I do thank you for that and for working for the COLA. I know that I had received lots of thank you letters for the little tiny COLA that we gave last time, and it was probably the only COLA thank you that I got for all of the COLAs that we had spent money on last time. So I do thank you for that. One question I had goes back to something that Representative Thiessen asked, and that was your A8 amendment on the agreement specifically to the rate increases in the COLA. And you said that the agreement was not contingent on the 5%, the 5 and 5. There was very strong abrasive repulsion of the governor's proposal at 4% from the group. So I'm wondering at what point we should vote no if this comes back at something less than 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean. I'm still holding out for 5. You know, we're 13% behind. So I'm still hopeful.
and that's why we're keeping the five in place going forward. So I'm living in the present, hoping for a gift.
Any other discussion? Then House File 721 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you to the testifiers and to Representative Fritz. And I think...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Hope to see you. Oh, Mr. House has returned. I'd like to move that House File 1408 be moved and recommended to pass, although I will change that motion at the end. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Obviously, this committee is going to know a whole lot more about what this bill does than I do, and so is the gentleman with me. But quite simply, in 2006, we passed Article Section 256B.69, Subdivision 23, that would allow the state to use federal dollars for the PACE program. And there was some language in there on page 3 of the bill you have before you, that the process for that's being deleted. The process for approval of these programs shall begin only after the commissioner receives grant money in the amount sufficient to cover the state share, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't work that way. The federal government won't give us money unless they have someone already in line to administer it. So what this bill basically does is on the appropriation, and I've been told so far the appropriation has been estimated at $380,000 a biennium for 1.5 FTEs, and 40% of that money will be reimbursed by the federal government. And we need basically it will allow this committee and the legislature to appropriate that money to the Commissioner of Human Services for the purpose of covering the state's share of the administrative cost of this program. So I'm assuming there's quite a bit of money there that we can access for care of our elderly, and I have a gentleman that could just maybe touch on some of the technical points of it.
Do you state your name for the tape, please?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Dan Strittmatter, and I work for Presbyterian Homes. I've been a nursing home administrator with them for the last 10 years, and I regret that my peers from the Winona area and the Crosby, Walker, Brainerd area couldn't be present in the Moorhead area, but they were supportive of this as well. Programs for the all-inclusive care for the elderly is for folks who are 55 and older, nursing home certified, and it's a federal program, an official federal program that has unique service components to it, some which overlap some of the programs in the state of Minnesota, others which are unique that do not exist in the state of Minnesota. There's a wonderful array of programs in Minnesota, and I'll give you an example of the contrast. I spoke with a gentleman last week who lived in a HUD income qualified building, and he's 85, eligible for Medicare and Medicaid in a Minnesota program right now. And he had recently had two hospital stays within 2 weeks, and he was now going to be meeting with his case manager, care coordinator, to talk about moving into assisted living. And the second stay he had was prolonged. They wouldn't let him out until they figured out what was wrong with him. He was instructed to meet with his primary care physician immediately upon discharge, and the earliest he could get in was a week later. And he lived in a building that was visited by a primary care physician, but that wasn't his, even though that was a physician that worked for one of the health plans that he was a member of. So he was unable to get the medical care. His main diagnosis was asthma. Under a PACE program, he would have been eligible for a PACE program. He would have been bused to a day center at least 3 days a week where numerous interdisciplinary staff, whether it's the bus driver or an activities professional or a nurse practitioner or the physician were all available, would see him on a regular basis and potentially head off one or both of these hospitalizations. PACE has been proven to reduce hospitalization number of days as well as incidents, and proven to save money as well. So those are the high points that I have. There are providers in rural and urban areas of the state that are very interested, and there are folks who would benefit from it and have been yet unable to benefit from it as a result of this very small barrier. And I want to thank Representative Howes and everybody else for their support.
Again, Representative Howes, the feds will match this at a 40% rate?
Mr. Chairman, the feds will pay 40%, reimburses 40% of our administrative cost, and then the PACE program will get federal dollars that we won't, maybe we will have to dish out that dollar, but it will be federal dollars. So our administrative cost is, we have to have an administrator simply to get the money. They won't give us the money, Mr. Chairman, unless they have somebody sign the check and say it's okay. And that, unfortunately, that costs us money.
Any discussion or questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howes, or your testifier. So right now, there's barriers in place that, like my nursing homes in my area, they have to meet certain criteria in order to get these grants, and this will free up that money? Is that correct?
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the federal money is there. It cannot be used in the program in the state of Minnesota without an administrator administering the program, and that would be the Commissioner of Human Services.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Howes, Representative Howes, that's the only barrier that we've had in place now for how long? And we've not been able to...
2 years.
That's it? 2 years? Thank you.
Any other discussion? Representative Howes, what's the total amount of federal dollars we would get in for the operating costs?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the funds come from the Elderly Waiver Program, so they already exist for current programs, as well as they come from the state's Medicaid acute care dollars and the federal Medicare and Medicaid dollars. So the funding is already there for existing programs, but some of the unique components don't exist.
Any questions, discussion? Seeing none, House File 1408 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And with that, meeting is adjourned.